free, minus plane ticket. Location, Chilean Patagonia, Rio Bacher. While Tim guides some scientists in Antarctica, I'm back in the Chilean backcountry with another large backpack on. I am alone, studying a roadless region, now of interest because it's about to have one. So while Tim and I aren't exactly right next door, at least we share a partial itinerary, the same hemisphere, and some mountain alone time at the end of this. I'm back to interview locals, ranchers, and those involved in the road's construction. The Carretera Austral will be the first road to take residents to southernmost Chile without needing Argentina to get there. The military is building it. Argentina and Chile haven't ever been the best of friends, not so good at sharing. I'm on my way to meet my friend Michelle at a footbridge at the bend of the verdant Bacher River, passing along its milky blue, through forests of Coyway and Lenga Beach and Patagonian cypress, crossing horse trails and calafate bushes, all with glaciated peaks out in the distance. It's getting dark. From behind me, an enormous blue military truck comes barreling down the new dirt road. It stops next to me, the diesel fumes cloud my vision. The truck's hefty driver rolls down his window. "No good, a woman alone here. Wherever it is you are going, we must give you a ride." "No te preocupes. I'm absolutely fa-" It appears they see me as a lady in distress, when really, I am just a lady who is late. But I can't refuse. I must say yes in the same polite way they must offer the ride. Chivalry commands it. "Ramon, give her a hand. Take her mochila." There is utter certainty and force in his graciousness. Arguing with my graying Chilean Marlon Brando would prove useless. "Gracias," I smile awkwardly, hoisting my pack to Ramon and then taking his offered hand, pulling me into the cab. It smells of cigarettes, body odor, and diesel. Marlon Brando is chatty. They drive me to that bend in the river. Michelle never shows. While I'm worried, we had a backup plan, so it will reconnect tomorrow. Brando refuses to let me camp alone.
"Absolutamente no. Aquí no. No podemos permitirlo."
He must protect me from the sense of danger a woman alone evokes. He now drives me to the military encampment. The next thing I know, Marlon ushers me through the camp headquarters. "You will have tea and biscuits with the captain. You must be hungry and tired. This requires tea," he says. I walk behind Brando through the dark, head down, with giant pack still on, under an open sky, past the entire squad of all-male soldiers who stand at attention for the Chilean version of TAPS. I don't know if I feel scolded or revered as I pass. I look up at the heavens and wonder where Tim is tonight under this map of stars. At the beginning of our romance, we promised to look at the night sky at the exact same time, no matter what time zone we each were in. On this night, just a brief glance skyward. Marlon introduces me to the captain, large South American mustache and all. "Come, come, tell me about your travels. We never have guests." We bounce between Spanish and English as I tell him of my research on the Carretera Austral. "Yes, everything will change now that we are here. This road will connect them to the world. The very first time for some of them. Providence, progress, Pinochet's crowning act." "Crowning act?" I say nothing. I smile and nod and reach for another biscuit. And now, biscuit in hand, the only thing keeping me from more dazzling conversation, apart from the frequently misconjugated verb, is that I can't stop staring at the giant oil painting behind the captain. It is of Pinochet, the former dictator and general of the army, who seems to stare me down as well. Has this captain, who keeps offering me hot biscuits and rosehip jam, tortured innocent civilians, crimes for which Pinochet is responsible? I try to avoid Pinochet's gaze. After enough chit-chat to tire even the most fluent of Spanish speakers, my captain says, "I must not keep you any longer. You will take my room. I will sleep elsewhere." All said with a certain fatherly care. "But I..." "Nonsense. I won't hear of it. Off we go. This way." I follow him to his small quarters with its papery thin temporary walls. The worry of a possible rape now fades into the background. If there were a rape attempt, I figure my screams would be heard through those walls in a heartbeat. I guess whether anyone would do anything about it is another question. Not sure I can picture Brando or anyone else coming to my rescue. I laugh to myself, thinking what Mom would say. Do you have a backup plan? In this case, no. No on all fronts. No to escape a rape. Nothing considered without a life with Tim. Mom loves to think of these worst-case scenario solutions. The hillside strangler in my tween years when Dad was away. I chose hairspray as my bedside weapon for the eyeballs and jacks on the floor for the toes to slow the strangler down. Apparently, I pictured a barefoot strangler. Mom's plans for my elaborate career as a dental hygienist, despite being at a great college. Her emergency snack stockpile everywhere she ventured, always overly healthy, like steamed kamut and almond butter, on the road or planted in any house she occupied. I can hear Dad. Thank goodness for the gallons of water she has stored, given your mother's survival choice of jars and jars of salty almond butter. Back in Patagonia, Captain Non-Rapist offers me his shower shoes for the morning and his music player for my entertainment. In this one moment, amid tiny teacups and stale bread, amid thoughts of thousands of men and women lost to torture, I try to wrap my brain around the fact that the same machine responsible for brutality is offering me shower thongs, a comfortable bed, and a prized officer's music player. Somehow, this changes me. The world has never looked more generous, never more cruel. Neither all black nor all white, both in the same moment. And my small problems, my missing friend, a heavy pack, the pressures of young love and graduate school, none of this will feel quite the same way again. Chapter 20, Wilderness First Responder, a woofer. Purpose, a national certification to handle emergencies in remote settings, wound management, vital signs assessment, fractures and dislocations, splinting, patient monitoring and long-term management, spinal immobilization and litter packaging, head/chest injuries, neurological, respiratory, and cardiac emergencies, diabetes, bites, stings, allergies, anaphylaxis, search and rescue, poisoning, lightning, shock, gender medical issues, fecal impaction, cold injuries. Duration, 80 hours in 10 days. Equipment needed, tape, scissors, gauze, etc., and a good set of lungs. Age, 26. Relationship status. No talk of marriage yet, although I'm starting to bring it up to Tim with hugely charming frequency. Not. Employment. A mishmash of Yale graduate student, retail shopkeeper, and graduate NPR intern. Cost, $600. Location, Missoula, Montana, and outside Pinedale, Wyoming. Back from Patagonia, it seems prudent to be prepared in solitude. I am my mother's daughter. Plus, shh, don't tell anyone, but I want to work as a wilderness educator. And what's not to love about knowing how to realign a broken femur, splint it, build a litter, and hike that poor bastard to the nearest roadhead? First aid paradise. There's nothing like blood-curdling yells coming from a patient with a fractured femur. Keeping this in mind, during femur break scenarios, I scream my bloody head off. Help me! Help me! Help me! My method acting might be a tad overkill, but it's heaven nonetheless. I mean, really, did you know men can get their testicles twisted up inside their scrotums? Must be extremely aggressive hiking. Fascinating. Apparently, safety never takes a vacation. I may be genetically encrypted to handle emergencies. All metaphysical New Age workshopping aside, my parents and Renee each have the same quality. We're your people if you're having an emergency. And we have a pretty broad definition for what constitutes one, so my family is an ace in the hole if you know us. But you likely don't know us because we busy ourselves living from one logistical scenario to the next. We don't, as a rule, have the strongest, let's socialize like regular people skills. It's one of our flaws. Afraid you'll miss your flight? We'll get you there. Roads closed due to bad weather? We'll get through. Car broken down in the middle of the night? We will locate and have located the right people to fix it, waking them without hesitation. Has the airline lost your luggage? We'll talk our way into the aircraft cargo to do a hand search. Need to get a vital message to someone at an unknown restaurant who can't be reached by phone? We'll convince every maitre d' to inspect every table at every restaurant. If someone thinks they saw him or her, we will acquire that witness's home number and question them. Have a relative lost at sea and the foreign government refuses to continue the search? We'll find the one off-duty ship with the one board captain who's looking for something to do. If that doesn't work, we'll procure and then paddle a rubber dinghy ourselves. We don't even need to stop for snacks. We feed on adrenaline. When others' energy fades, we're just warming up. And the beauty? We're so into it, people don't even get irritated. We usually get them caught up in the infectious, life-of-its-own energy that an emergency holds. The Griswolds are not so good with the boring everyday stuff. Picking up the dry cleaning? Yuck. Regular grocery shopping? Who cares? We only like it when we've been collectively digging a hole in the front yard and it becomes obvious we should take a break because a few people have keeled over. Then we will handle both situations efficiently, dropping the unconscious people off at the emergency room on the way to the market. It's probably why we are particularly suited to courses with the word intensive or immersion in the title. They all involve a certain intensity, an enthusiastic beginning, a grueling middle, a tearful end. Perfect. So give me that hypothermic, head-injured climber in a diabetic coma with testicular torsion and fecal impaction, and let's do this. If pressed, I know how to curve my finger just so. I never understood the technique involving a metal spoon, though. That must be the advanced course. And I don't think I'll volunteer as a pretend patient. Up next in our woofer, a multi-hour rescue exercise. We find our victims in various states of shock, covered in the requisite tomato paste blood with massive head trauma and broken limbs. My assignment? Calm a shock-ridden wife who's running around in river-soaked clothes, which we've agreed must be removed. Help me, my patient calls. Somebody needs to help my husband. He's in the river. Why isn't anyone doing anything? Janet, I can assure you we're doing everything we can for Steve. Now, I say, taking her hand strongly, why don't we get off those soaked pants? I've gotten her pants off, but she breaks away. She's running loose with no pants. I chase her through some trees, grab her gently but firmly, and sit her down on a rock. Let's get you some dry pants, shall we? Which do you like better, tea or cocoa? We're getting some hot water fired up for you right now. But Megan, what if Tim were in trouble? Wouldn't you freak out? Wow, she's taking the scenario to a whole new level. Yes, but the best way to help Steve is to stay calm so we can think clearly. We're going to need your help, okay? Now, which do you prefer, cocoa or Bengal spice? Cocoa sounds good. Perfect. Our patient's first aid scenario, husband, remains in the river with a head injury wrapped in the burrito method, aka ridiculous amounts of sleeping bags, to prevent hypothermic shock. He looks like the banana in the Fruit of the Loom commercial. But in this case, the large banana man is currently submerged in a river. Wife calmed and repanted, I'm off to locate where to land a helicopter should our runners make good time by nightfall. I'm high as a kite. I don't fret over anything because, even just hypothetically, there's no need to worry the worst might happen. It's here. Mom would love this, as would Renee. She just might not dig the outdoor part. And if Renee's femur were shattered, pretend or otherwise, she would be far more polite about it. And Dad would nominate himself the group's incident commander while orienting the map upside down, passionately sending us not to the roadhead, but possibly off a lovely cliff. But with that blind enthusiasm, I promise the troops would love him for it. Chapter 21, First Official Counseling Session. Purpose. My parents are getting a divorce. A Federal Express envelope came to New Haven, Connecticut, right before spring break, telling me so. It was signed by both of them. I want to talk to someone. FedEx isn't all that conversational. Duration, 1 hour. Equipment needed. A borrowed car while visiting the parentals. But where I will go with Mom's car is private. Age, 27. relationship status. Tim's parents went through this a few years ago. I don't know where to put the grief. Our family might have been fractured, but it was mine. Employment. Full-time graduate student with part-time work gigs. Cost. Reduced rate of $50. She's my friend's mother and the only counselor I know. Location. Costa Mesa, California. The counselor's name was Mickey, as in mouse. If I'm totally honest, I told Mickey while sitting in her office, which appeared trapped in the year 1986, either that or I had a guest spot on Miami Vice. I wasn't sure what a counselor was supposed to do. Do they just listen or do they dispense advice? Or both? There should be a rule book explaining these things. I just launched in. I think I thought all those workshops might help keep them together, or us together. I mean, nobody told me to take them all. That was sort of my idea, or the group idea. Like, we were all in this boat together, and you don't leave a sinking ship. You paddle. Get really smart about this life stuff, this love stuff, any way you can. Then put those skills to practice. Keep the ship afloat. Now what? It's over. I'm a failure. My father says he's sorry I choose to experience this divorce as a problem. He thinks it's wonderful. I wanted to talk to someone who at least thinks it's okay to see it as a problem. That's very admirable, she said. Admirable, I asked, to want to talk to someone or to see this as a problem? Neither. It's admirable to want to fix it. I don't think it's admirable. I think I'm off my nut. Chapter 22, The Astrobivy. Purpose. Astro, meaning of or relating to stars. Bivy, short for bivouac. A lightweight sack that slips over a sleeping bag, rendering a tent unnecessary. While the term bivouac is a technical one, it can also describe any time you sleep out without a tent. Add the word astro and you've got a night under a blanket of stars on a high peak. Duration. One night. Equipment needed. One sleeping bag, one pad, one hat. Age, 27. Relationship status. In love and so proud to be with Timmy Tim Tim, yet also grateful to be able to do this mountain professional training on my own. Employment. In process. Working to get hired as a wilderness expedition leader. Cost, free. Location, the Wind River Range, Wyoming. While I've been moving in the wilderness direction, Dad has apparently been privately wooing his married, unrequited love from his Christian Science College days. He says it's all in a platonic, family-friendly way while he waits for his divorce to go through. Her husband is a wheelchair-bound stroke survivor and, like his wife, a hardcore traditional Christian scientist. Apparently Dad has been writing metaphysical open letters to both of them, and only she writes back. Dad has been visiting and pledging his platonic love for her to the husband and the wife both. The husband must love that. Not to sound crass, but to catch you up, the husband has now died unexpectedly a few months later, and Dad announces her existence to us for the first time in his plans to marry her. Dad, isn't it a little awkward that last week you were the family friend and this week you're the fiancé? I'm not trying to be obnoxious. I really want to know. Oh, Megan. I think I've blocked out what he said beyond that. Whatever he says, it suggests that I'm not being super positive on the whole thing. He's right. I feel for the family. Her grown children just lost their dad. And it's hard to train the emperor has no clothes kid out of me. I love it about me, and I hate it about me. Both. But maybe, and I promise I'm not trying to be snarky here, if Christian scientists don't believe in death, maybe the wife doesn't need to mourn? So Dad's on the wedding track. They're planning the event for Mother's Day. Ouch. Our mom. So Mom is trying to make a new life for herself, single, at 65. As for Renee, she's gotten a corgi. I begged her to. I'm thankful she said goodbye to her Napoleonic complex, know-it-all boyfriend, Doug, so she can welcome in someone special. As for myself, I sit in the mountains for the equivalent of a month-long job interview to become a wilderness teacher. Maybe I'll finally fit in somewhere. I love the mountains. I love Tim. I love my outdoor-loving, natural history, ornithology, geology-studying, climb-ski, paddle-worshipping friends. When I left for the course, Dad had broken up with his fiance. To be honest, it gives me a tremendous sense of relief to not have a new stepmom just yet. The last thing Dad asks me before I head into the mountains, "Megan, what do you think all this love stuff is about?" I rattle on for at least 15 minutes, but circle around to cliches and things I hope to be true about love. "Dad, I think you have to love yourself first and not be afraid to be alone for a bit without Mom, without anyone. It might be a great learning." Who was I to talk? I had grabbed onto Tim like a life raft as soon as he'd kissed me and never considered an alternative. Unknown to me, Dad's solo learning will last 2 weeks, but for now, I take comfort in having everything I need on my back, in the company of 14 equally ambitious outdoor worker types surrounding me in the mountains. And tonight, 3 weeks in, the weather looks like a solid go. It's clear. The sun is setting. It's August, the best time to be in the winds. The clear sky screams astrobivy. On a full stomach of pesto pasta and a giant hot chocolate, I leave our camp in the fading light. I cross the small creek that gurgles in that way I only imagine happens in the most romantic of gentle summer love stories. I cut through the meadow up to a small saddle. To the left is a bald granite peak that today I can't seem to remember the name of. Despite being in the middle of this month-long interview, tonight it feels like I'm off the clock. I'm not worried about my performance or the class I have yet to teach or the epic debrief I had with the instructor team when I failed to descend a climb fast enough in an impending lightning storm. I want my face under the stars. All 15 of us are buzzing with excitement from the break in routine. Casual chat rumbles softly as the group makes its way up the peak. There's no trail, just one rock after the next, boulder by boulder. All anybody's got with them is a headlamp and a sleeping bag, so we move efficiently. We reach the top in the fading light. It's bright enough to capture a few silly photographs of the group in silhouette. I wonder why I can't live up here, gazing at the expansive view to the west where the range fades to prairie. I select the perfect spot, snuggled in a rock alcove with a view of the stars so vivid, I'm certain no movie, no light show, no performance will ever compare. I don't know if I believe in God, but if I did, I suspect God would live here. Or if not live here, then she would certainly consider this spot when feeling particularly spiritual. I wonder whether my molecules are being rearranged in response to the beauty. The beast in me feels soothed. In this moment, life isn't just bearable or a mixed bag. It feels full and round and tingles everywhere. I feel my toes curl with excitement at the bottom of my bag. I let my eyes peek out from under my hat but keep everything else covered in my womb cocoon. I feel like I am 6 years old with that volume of glee that threatens to blow me apart with happiness. And then I see it, a flash of light. And then another. It's lightning. The flashes are moving. Closer. I won't make the same mistake twice, which means we must descend. I scramble for my headlamp. Without speaking, the entire group has gone into retreat mode. It's understood the bivvy is over. I wonder whether the nature of the divine is to only get small, vibrant tastes. Maybe the point is to savor it like one special chocolate wrapped in fine paper, rather than a box of them in bulk. Maybe it's better this way, to leave one wanting more. A reminder that life, even in its full pageantry, can be gone in a flash. Chapter 23. Traditional Chinese Medicine. Purpose. Concerned primarily with the external causes of disease. Wind, cold, damp, heat, dryness, and summer heat. These cover anything from aches and inflammation to sluggishness to pathogens that wander and change. My diagnosis? liver qi stagnation with dampness and false heat. My pulses, wiry. Duration. Weekly treatments when treating both acute and chronic conditions. Equipment needed. The telltale sign of a TCM student, they appear to be wearing a hempish outfit purchased at the health food store. Age, 28. Relationship status. I wonder why it looks easier for my father to plunge into marriage than for me. Cost, $20 at student clinic. Location, Bastyr University, Kenmore, Washington. Dad has remarried. Happened as soon as the divorce was final. He did it while I was finishing my Wilderness Guides course. When it began, like I said, he was single. At the end, another Federal Express envelope greeted me, this time with a small note and a wedding photo. Good old FedEx. It's a nice picture of the two of them, big smiles and fancy clothes. He's in a new gray suit and she a silvery ball gown, like a non-anorexic inaugural Nancy Reagan. Now, the fact that I don't know the people standing on either side of them is more than a little disconcerting, but there it is. I think the people beside them are my new stepmother's Christian Science practitioner and his wife. Not sure. I'm out of Yale. Tim has proposed. I was standing in my kitchen in New Haven when it happened, in my ratty pink sweatpants, my go-to study outfit. Tim calls them my depressed pants. He stood in contrast with his crisp button-down and J. Crew khakis. While I puttered over cereal, he put his two hands out toward me. Two fists, like a shell game. Pick a hand, he said. I picked his right. He turned over his hand, opened his palm, and there it was, a solitaire diamond ring, his mother's ring. I looked up and down, between his face and his hand, stunned. He smiled nervously, almost apologetically, with a diminutive tilting of his head side to side, like a metronome. I don't understand. Are you asking to marry me? Is that what this is? Was it unkind of me to make him spell it out? He nodded yes. Wow. But I thought we weren't talking about this stuff. The 3-month moratorium. To not push the marriage question like I was. He shrugged nervously, and as if it were just another day, he said, I wanted to ask you earlier in the weekend, but you were pretty distracted with your UN class with Sylvia. Sorry, but we kind of have to hurry if I'm going to catch the train back to Providence and make my afternoon class. I nod, still thinking. He said, ask. Is it asking if you don't say anything? With the ring still in my left hand, my right grabbed my purse and headed with him to my rusty Subaru to sprint him to the station. We didn't say much in the car. This felt so out of the blue and so quiet. As he undid his seatbelt, I asked, if I put it on my finger, could that mean I'm thinking about it? I don't want to have my silence hurt his feelings. What if I'm crushing him in my pausing? Maybe that was really hard for him. Yes, he said. I called Mom after dropping Tim off. I think Tim just asked me to marry him. It was a little different. He couldn't seem to say anything. Is that normal? Is that how this should go? Mom adores Tim, as ever. As do I. I think I do. Why wouldn't I? Oh, Megan, this is what you've wanted. Was it? Truly? Don't overthink this one. Just leap. We hung up, and I called Tim. My can-I-think-about-it phase lasted about an hour. I didn't want to distress him, and Mom was right, wasn't she? So now we are engaged and live in Bellingham, Washington, and I work as a freelance radio reporter, house cleaner, and mountain instructor. I'm still figuring out how to put my training and interests together, but I don't totally know how to go about it. I kind of want National Geographic meets NPR, but more urgently, or conveniently distracting from career questions, my breaths are bugging me. 3 weeks of every cycle, they ache and ache badly, like giant cantaloupe bruises. The breast search has begun. I try it all. The anti-candida diet. I burst into a spontaneous yeast infection after a bowl of cereal on a pre-dawn hike. Screw that. Ashtanga yoga. I practice 5 to 6 days a week from 6 to 8 a.m. Ayurveda. I'm Vata Kapha. The blood type diet. Lots of iodine and red meat, apparently as an O. I'm a hunter, not a gatherer. Sure, that sort of fits. I've gotten Rolfed, yes, all 10 sessions. It will help my posture and make my pelvis drop and ribcage protrude, and I will sob like a baby. All these are considered good things. But my breasts still hurt like a mother. Tim thinks my experiments are funny. I joke about my quest all the time. He's not into the searching thing. He says he's happy with himself and doesn't need to change or explore. He isn't looking for solutions to anything, and his chest is fine. I refuse to believe there's something wrong with curiosity. The world is a big place with lots of creative solutions, especially if I look hard enough and stay curious. So I will try acupuncture. And now, in the student clinic, I've never had a group of people so fascinated to check out my tongue. Either they're easily amused or they don't have televisions. They poke, prod, needle, and give me hideous herbs that stink up the house and ask me if I sweat at night. One intern is concerned I have a goiter. I try to reassure him it's simply my fat neck, which gets fatter under stress. I swear. The fat goes straight to my neck, avoiding my hips entirely. Lucky me. The TCM acupuncture lowers my breast pain by a week. That's something. Just not enough. Chapter 24. Ashtanga Yoga, Mysore Style. Purpose. Yoga is exercise I can do that doesn't require strapping my breasts into an industrial-strength jog bra when PMS rears its swollen head. Frequency / duration. 5 to 6 days a week, 2 hours a day, 6 to 8 a.m. Equipment needed. A thick mat is nice, but not required. Age, 28 to present, depending on my mood. Relationship status. I've been practicing yoga because I feel this loneliness sometimes with Tim. Or maybe it's only within myself. Yoga helps fill me up. Employment. Wilderness teacher, personal assistant, substitute yoga teacher, freelance radio reporter. How are all these jobs going to come together? Cost. The same as going to a moderately priced gym. Location. Bellingham, Washington. Do your practice and all is coming. K. Patabi Joyce. Mom is completely devastated, Dad marrying so suddenly. I'm trying to get to know my stepmother and her adult children, quite a bit older than Renee and me, and be gracious. She's kind to me, but we speak a different language. She has strong Christian Science views on how the world is, so I'm very careful with my words. I want her to like me. I don't want to step on any metaphysical toes. So no talk of problems, or the body, or graphic humor, or boobs. She's devout. No doctors, no medicine, vitamins might as well be heroin. No messy talk about emotions or negativity. Good luck with this, self, as the messy stuff is about the only thing that interests me. I hope to get to know my dad on his own, like really finally know him. I wanted to somehow pass through, via osmosis, this formidable, energetic bubble that encases and radiates around him. It's clear, so I can see him, but it's like this sphere renders out of reach any closeness, connection, or fatherly something. The bubble of energy is large. It could fill a small New York studio apartment or, minimally, a freight elevator. Yet somehow, my stepmom speaks enough of his language or thinks enough of his thoughts that she's welcomed. She inhabits a similar bubble. I imagine they overlap like a Venn diagram. Or maybe their bubbles kiss. Perhaps because he can't imagine a moment where his bubble doesn't kiss hers, he hasn't let Renee or me see or talk to him on his own. It stings. I build my own routine to help me not think about all that too much. And this yoga is what I've come up with. It's 6 a.m. The room is dark and warm. Walking into practice is like burrowing into a seashell as the student's Ujjayi breath technique sounds like the ocean. Each morning I place my mat right next to Tracy. Our friendship exists in our daily proximity, breathing and twisting into all sorts of postures side by side. She's further along in the second series than I, which means she spends more time with her legs behind her head. And while I stuff my legs behind my neck and drop into back bends and bind my hands around my torso this way and that, I'll tell you what my actual practice consists of. Regardless of the warm room, the burning candles, and the room full of heavy breathers, where it's truly fiery is on the inside. This is the material of my practice. I feel a lot. I feel a lot of the time. I have a lot of energy, which gives me a lot of time to do stuff and then feel a lot about it. It appears that one of my life's passions has been the following. I seem to like to worry, then criticize myself, then worry some more. Occasionally, I think a couple of really solid thoughts. Then I worry some more. Then I worry about worrying. Then I judge myself for being a worrier who worries too much. Then I worry about how I judge myself about worrying that I worry too much. Then I worry that I judge that I worry about worrying. Then I just worry. Then I get sad that I wasted so much time worrying. Then I get sad that I feel so sad. Then I am disgusted that I felt so sad about worrying. Then I fantasize a couple of things about myself and then about a couple of other people. Then I work for a while and have a couple of really good thoughts. And this morning, I don't know if they're good thoughts. I can't stop thinking about, wait for it, my dad, Renee, and my recent trip to SeaWorld. We'd been asking if we could just see him on our own, and we got no after no. Some weird idea he got into his head that alone time would hurt his new wife. I don't know why she would mind, but that's what he thought. Then somewhere in there, SeaWorld came up. Dad seems to think this trip to SeaWorld can clear up every problem we've had this past year. The way Renee and I worried for Mom, who felt blindsided by the divorce, having the first time we hear of Margie, let alone his plans to marry, be 4 days after her husband's passing. Renee and I not experiencing our father as particularly compassionate in the divorce terms for a 35-year marriage to a now 66-year-old woman, and finally, his spending the holidays only with Margie's family. All the while, I'm dying to know him away from all our family drama because I crave something, anything, from him. Yet he feels like a Tower of Babel I have not the foggiest idea how to climb, and Shamu is his only offer. We navigate this sweaty San Diego asphalt parking lot with attendants in orange vests and occasional acne directing us through a maze of RVs. Renee and I follow like we really are 10 again, falling in line behind our big-bellied dad in his acid-wash jeans, white sneakers, and go-to shirt with his Valve Company's logo and a tiny bit of armpit sweat. I can't decide if it's breaking my heart or if it infuriates me that he sees things so simply. He just looks so cute rushing ahead to beat the line at the ticket window. An attendant offers to take our picture with the walking Shamu. Normally, Dad would say no to this, insisting they are milking us. But today, he's game. Consulting the map, he says, "Now, girls, if we hurry, we can see the penguin performance. We've got 3 minutes. Let's go, let's go!" Obedient girl women, we start lightly jogging to keep up, passing hundreds of sweaty, less hurried Americans. He excuse me, pardon me's himself to the middle of the amphitheater to make sure we have the centermost seats both vertically and horizontally. "I do think this is the best location, although maybe we can get this gentleman to move down a bit. Sir, would you mind?" Here we go. The man who can't be embarrassed, who, after our trip to Ringling Brothers Circus, drove our sedan the wrong way up the exit ramp to follow the elephants, becoming the special envoy lead car in a parade of fellow unauthorized vehicles, flashing lights and sirens. My sister and I hunkered down on cue, State Patrol at our window. From the dolphin presentation on to the Shark Tank diorama, his sprinting routine continues. I'm not sure how much time we will actually spend together if this keeps up.
I think we can just make it to the walrus and sea otter show.
Oh, God. I think that's the one where they dress the walrus up in costumes. I haven't been here since sixth grade. This is one of those moments I can't look at Renee. I'm 28 and off to watch a French-made walrus.
"How about some cotton candy?" he asks.
I can't bear to tell him we're not 10 anymore, and that Renee's idea of a treat is more in the fondue department or a nice Cabernet. And mine, when it comes to cotton candy, let's just say I've never taken the idea of bulimia seriously, but it will force me to consider dabbling. Sure, Dad, we say in unexpected unison, surrounded by overfed families with toddlers digging into corn dogs in the food court. I feel a little sick. I've been watching over-tanned trainers dump buckets of tubby dead fish into the mouths of sea life of various sizes for about 4 hours now. Renee and I can't bear to look at each other. If we do, we'll have to admit that this breaks our hearts. About 15 years too late. I don't want this to be true. We love him too much. Each of us wants his attention and enthusiasm so badly, we'd probably jump into the shark tank if we thought it would please him. So I eat cotton candy, feeling my jeans tightening. Renee eats the pink cloud while glancing around for something like, minimally, a bad beer to wash it down. The tanks of fish, in a weird way, helped, gave us something to focus on. Upon exiting the park, we stop to pick up our group portrait. Renee and I look surprisingly similar, some mixture of bewilderment and sadness, all underneath toothy smiles. Dad is in the middle with Shamu, looking like he's never seen something cooler than a walking, talking, furry killer whale. Renee and I want to tell him that we've had the time of our lives. We'll say something like that, but it's not true. Dad doesn't know how to have all that regular of conversations, and there are about 17 conversations we're not having. His being back in his family's fold, his rush to marry, Mom's settlement, and perhaps the hardest to admit that it seems he no longer needs any of us. Chapter 25, The Ongoing Class with Lawrence, Revisited. Purpose. Sometimes one must pause to consider whether one's teacher is sufficiently consistent with what's being taught. Duration, 1 weekend a month, and lots of homework. Equipment needed, none. Age, 28. Relationship status. Earnest, sometimes annoyingly so, questioning student to one comfortably hierarchical teacher. Cost. If I stop studying with Lawrence, it will definitely save me money. Humiliation factor. A top note of humiliation in a shipra of disillusionment. Location, Bellingham, Washington. A phone call. Lawrence has been sitting in front of me on a stage well above my sight line for about a decade, month in, month out, year in, year out. He's encouraged me to think rationally, not too emotionally, and to be the same person in private as I am in public. Whether I've learned that way of being is another question entirely. I think I'm pretty good with being my same self in public as I am in private, and given what I just learned about Lawrence, I'm thinking I'm better at it than he is. What I do know is I've never felt that Lawrence understood how with love and human emotion, we're not designed to always act in a measured, rational way. I seem to be the only person noticing this blind spot in his theories in class. I wonder if I mind. Minimally, it might be time to stop talking to him as an authority figure. The mighty sure can tumble. Lawrence has apparently been sleeping with, slash dating, slash being intimate with one of his students. Word got out, and so his team of all-female staffers are calling all the students to do damage control, get ahead of the gossip, control the spin, in case we hadn't heard, and I hadn't. What bothers me most isn't what you might think. I never expected Lawrence to be a superhero free of human desire, but I suspect he did. For myself, I realize I've been tiptoeing for years around something about spiritual teaching and leadership. That putting yourself at the front of any room as an expert, especially in spirituality, is dangerous. I've sat with some sort of leader or another at the front of a room for decades now, and I've noticed that this kind of front-of-the-room power can go to the front-of-the-room person's head. And more often than not, it does. It seems especially easy for men. Just saying. They have the confidence to put themselves there and often enough arrogance to justify behavior they didn't exhibit before they became a leader. It's about impossible to not start believing the hype you've created about yourself. For all Lawrence's measuredness, the one thing I was convinced was missing from his paradigm was the messiness of love. So maybe it surprised Lawrence, but it didn't surprise me. He broke his own rule, a class rule, against sexual involvements in the class and started dating, can you even call it that, from within his own, from the teacher position no less. It did not surprise me, nor did it surprise me, but it did disappoint, that he didn't choose to be intimate with the age-appropriate and intellectual equal, the professor and poet. He picked the young, malleable, hero-worship participant. So I'm going to exit. No big speeches. Not because Lawrence slept with Jessica, the doe-eyed woman of average intellect. I'm out because I don't like the way I just got spun. His female staffers are complicit, and instead of just owning the facts, they are throwing Jessica's mental stability into question, calling her the vindictive, spurred woman and all that. This crushes me, too, as I don't just believe in the brotherhood of man, but the sisterhood as well. All beings. And they just threw one of ours to the wolves of judgment and one-sided narratives. Lawrence, I suspect you believed you were above error. I never did. I don't want to be taught by someone who doesn't know this. I forgive you your human frailties. I do not condone your speaking ill of a student who put her trust in you. I'm out. Chapter 26. Classical Five-Element Licentiate, Acupuncture School. Purpose. System of Chinese medicine to address physical, emotional, and spiritual concerns. Developed over thousands of years, identifying pathways of energy called meridians, which enliven the body. Duration. 3 years of training, then clinicals, then national exams. Equipment needed. Needles. And moxa, an herb you burn on the point before needling. Age, 29. Relationship status, engaged. Employment. I'm ditching the reporter direction. I know it's an insane switch. But in reporting, they want me to feel neutral about whatever story I'm covering, and I can't seem to feel neutral. It's cringe-inducing to add more graduate school in a family that doesn't believe in it, and pricey to jump ship like this, but I'm compelled. I don't want to just hear people's heartbreaking stories. I want to help do something about them. Cost, $75 to $100 per session as a patient. Location. Institute of Taoist Education and Acupuncture, Louisville, Colorado, and Bellingham, Washington. Follow the nothingness of the Tao, and you can be like it, not needing anything, seeing the wonder and the root of everything. And even if you cannot grasp this nothingness, you can still see something of the Tao in everything. Tao Te Ching. It started easily enough. On the breast quest, I became a five-element patient. The first appointment and intake was nothing I had ever experienced. Not only was I asked to elaborately detail every fluid that has ever come out of me, the questions about my family and personal life would give Freud a run for his money. My mother has moved up to Whidbey Island to be closer to Tim and me, and to her dream of a pack of dogs and a farm. Dad and my stepmother have moved to Lake Tahoe into what we all think of as Mom's cabin. Renee, in Oakland, listened to me and not only got a dog, but is taking her first road trip. A big deal. Some outdoor friends that I hope she likes are on her itinerary. She has a new boyfriend, Mark, but I don't think, from my view in the cheap seats, he's kind enough. She deserves to find a real love connection. With all this swirling around me, I wasn't even sure what I wanted. My secret? I dreamed of a more artistic professional life. And I liked the flexibility that working for myself in acupuncture would provide while I figured out the art part. Whatever I eventually fit in creatively, I could still make a living. Plus, I liked the mysterious traditions of five-element acupuncture. This was my kind of something. I mean nothing. This was my kind of nothing. The diagnosing hooked me. Talk about a detective searching for clues, studying the color, sound, odor, and emotion of each person. It's all about retraining the senses, to see subtle color on a face, smell a constitutional odor, to hear the predominant sound in a voice, to sense an underlying emotion, and no tongue inspection required. The five elements, fire, earth, metal, water, wood, describe in metaphor the cyclical harmony of the natural world, as well as the functions of the body, five colors from which to choose, five odors, five sounds, five emotions, categorize each and you're in business. I, for example, am earth, metal, metal, meaning I'm yellow, at least this yellow stuff is consistent, with a bit of shiny white swirled in. Look around the eyes and mouth. My odor is fragrant, think vomit, mixed with rotten, think dead animal or, feces. My sound, a sing and a weep within. And my emotion, worry with a little grief for good measure. Yep, that pegs it. Earth relates to the mother, finding, needing a sense of home. Meta relates to the father, the heavens, a quest for spiritual understanding. Every element is different. Fire, my mother, smells scorched. Water, my sister, like a tide pool. Wood, rancid, my lovely Tim. Metal, rotten. I've yet to definitively diagnose Dad, but I think metal. Doesn't the South sound delicious? But here's the hitch. Diagnosing is extraordinarily difficult, and the harder you try, the harder it gets. You train to smell with your ears, see with your nose, listen with your eyes, and so on. If you're lucky enough to get 3 out of the 4 legs of the stool, make a diagnosis, assign an element, and treat the corresponding organs, then your patient's on her way to glowing health. Lest you think you're getting off easy, throw in the pressure of getting the proper point location, corrected within the tip of a pen, and precise needle angle and depth, and you must also plan the right treatment, which feels more akin to poetry. Each point is said to have a particular spirit, names like fly and scatter, grasping the wind, spirit burial ground, but pick the wrong element or point or do so at the wrong time of day, in the wrong season, and your treatment is totally, and this is a clinical term, fucked. If you don't enjoy the hunt, it's a wonderful way to get an ulcer. No one understands this better than my exacting classmate, Coco. She's a delight in contradictions. She can ask the most dead serious, insightful question in class, and then at break time, be the one doing a little elfin dance as we circle to eat our overcooked Chinese vegetables. As the Pied Piper of the group, she enacts the best imitations of our stuffiest teachers, their idiosyncratic movements and expressions, turning them up a notch to perfection. She has the self-reliance of a single mother of 2 teenage boys, but will always report the most hilarious moment of the day when she comes up for air. Sometimes, when telling a story, her laughter can get the best of her before she gets a word out. But then, if anyone's having a hard time, she can meet them with utter seriousness and compassion, giving them her razor-sharp focus and kind ear. And if you're lucky, a back massage. That's what she did before acupuncture school. She has all this spirit, even in the face of a massive challenge. She's going blind. For real. After she began acupuncture school, she learned she has a rare genetic condition called pseudoxanthoma elasticum, which causes the degeneration of her connective tissue, leading her macula to hemorrhage and to permanent loss over time. Imagine all that spirit in the face of such devastating news. She's flat out extraordinary. Picture this. A wood sprite of a brunette with cropped hair, bangs, hazel eyes, a petite former dancer coming in right around the 5'1" mark, although she insists on a good day there's an additional all-important 3/4. To look after her eyes, she avoids high-impact anything, so she walks for exercise with this perky gait and a backside you'd kill for, all wearing some de rigueur, pretty awful, eye-protecting, bottle-thick sunglasses. She possesses an internal authority I imagine she was born with and then cultivated in the farmlands of her native Iowa. And P.S., you should know she made me call her Coco in these pages because she says her parents gave her a terribly boring name. And the name Coco definitely has that je ne sais quoi that she does. And so the two of us, from whatever forces collided for us to meet, delight in each other. It started when our touchy-feely school assigned us to do a skit on the fire element. We laughed our heads off and got the information across, we think. We share a freakishly inexhaustible obsession to develop these highly specific, rather intangible sensory skills. Our shared wonder at the enormity of awakening our senses binds us. We also share hefty self-doubt for how in the world a removed-from-nature human can awaken one's senses like this. Barring a move to the Arctic to live among the planet's best trackers, we want the nose, eyes, ears, and minds of those indigenous peoples, coupled with the knowledge of the best medical clinicians. The Yupik people, for example, have 99 different distinctions for sea ice. We want this sensitivity, but with people. We share the strange combination of receiving top exam scores while scoring highest at feeling forever insufficient. All this is, of course, made more complex for Coco as she's losing one of those senses. So the development of her others, touch, smell, sound, and emotional awareness, is that much more crucial. To be five element students means being excited that Coco can smell my confirmed diagnosis as earth and metal. Fragrant, sickly sweet, like an overripe greenhouse or, say, vomit, and rotten, like a discarded ground beef wrapper or, more classically stated, poop.
But Coco deflates to learn that on that day, I had donned a lilac essential oil peppered with a bad case of gas.
A bottom note, as it were. Damn it. And did I mention the 12 energetic wrist pulses corresponding to the 12 organs? Like the rest, push too hard and you'll misdiagnose entirely. This is way better than becoming a reporter. Fits my detective fantasy, too. I get to smell people till I want to puke, stare at faces till a subtle color emerges, and listen to the sounds people emit when sharing their deepest, darkest. Then press on the wrist and ask Coco, what in the H-E-L-L do you feel? Tim thinks it's all a little strange, but he's supportive. So this is what I've become about. If I'm lucky enough to pick the right element, right day, right point, for the right person, I get to help a fellow traveler with depression or a busted knee or infertility. Not to mention, this is another way to understand Tim. He's my well-meaning, well-mannered puzzle. Chapter 27. Read Getting the Love You Want by Harville Hendrix. Purpose. Get better at intimate relationships. More specifically,